Our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a doting son.
Do not contact the authorities. Do not get the FBI involved.
Becomes a kidnapper's meal ticket.
He knew we had access to some large amounts of cash.
And later, a greedy hand reaches from the underworld.
Basically making a living smuggling heroin into the country.
Dragging a wealthy family into the darkness.
The body was so badly decomposed that identification had to be done by fingerprints.
I'm Christopher Mason. The Protestant work ethic suggests that hard work is the path to prosperity and a ticket to heaven. But some who decide to take the shortcut to riches will surely find themselves at the burning gates of hell when they kill for cash.
April 2008, wealthy businessman Tom Wiles checks his email and sees a message about his son, Robert.
At first, I thought it was a joke.
But this is no April Fool's prank.
It said that Robert had been kidnapped.
Basically, it was a ransom email. It said, you will get your son back if you give us $750,000.
When most of us fly, we buy a ticket on someone else's plane. When the rich fly, they don't need a ticket. They take their own jet. Keeping those private planes in the air is big business.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No one knows that better than Tom and Pamela Wiles.
Hi, Pam.
They own this multi-million dollar company, National Flight Services, with locations all around the country.
Primary business is the maintenance business of airplanes, primarily general aviation airplanes. So it encompasses everything from flight schools to charter airplanes.
They've built their aviation business from the ground up. And now they're flying with the big boys.
They had a lot of money, and it was a very well-established company.
The rising star of National Flight Services is their son, Robert.
Robert was a good man. He was accomplished in most things that he did.
He came up with a software update, the fantastic, it's all sorted.
I think it was assumed that someday he was going to take over the company.
Rob helps run the company's Florida branch in Lakeland, just outside of Tampa. Living close to the Gulf of Mexico is the perfect life for the 26-year-old outdoorsman.
Robert Wiles was this young, athletic guy, loved to fish, loved to be on the water.
He was quite good at it, and he would get his little 21-foot boat and go out 35 miles offshore and get some of the biggest fish I've ever seen.
On April 1st, 2008,
yeah, it's happening.
Robert Wiles is working late in his office at Lakeland Airport. As the boss's son, he wants to set a good example by putting in extra hours.
He was kind of getting a pretty good background in the business. He actually worked in the parts department and sales support and things like that.
Robert is still at work around 6:30 p.m., according to the firm's operations manager, Toby Holt. But after that, Robert vanishes. 2 days later, Robert's father, Tom Wiles, gets the ransom email.
They signed it to Group X. They wanted $750,000.
Part of that letter said, whatever you do, do not contact the authorities. Do not get the FBI involved.
Do not call the police. Do not tell anybody. Do not let anybody know what's going on.
Tom Wiles ignores the kidnappers and calls the police.
It's really not a good idea for somebody to try to handle it on their own.
Jim Orr is an FBI special agent assigned to the Robert Wiles kidnapping case.
The FBI has a lot of experience working kidnapping cases, and we have a pretty good track record as far as safely retrieving people where that's possible.
The Wiles family is in good hands. These investigators don't flinch when it comes to hunting down a good lead.
What's been going on in the victim's life? Have they been acting strangely lately? Have there been any unusual incidents involving them?
The FBI wants to know where Robert has been and who he's been associating with. The answers span half the globe.
Robert was dealing with customers in Thailand, in Colombia, in Jordan, in the Middle East.
There are countries like that where it's pretty common to kidnap people for ransom, and once they get paid, they let them go.
And that's exactly why National Flight Services took out kidnapping insurance.
We were doing more traveling in South America, Central America. I wanted to be sure that we had sufficient ransom money to get our people back.
That insurance policy is worth $750,000. Exactly the same amount as the ransom demand. Inside knowledge or just a coincidence? It gives the FBI food for thought. Robert Wiles' international business connections are keeping investigators busy. But the real clues to this mystery are turning up much closer to home.
Robert had told his barber that he was unhappy with his life.
At the time he disappeared, Robert Wiles was having a crisis.
I know Robert was not terribly happy at that particular time.
His dreams lie at the wheel of a fishing charter boat out in the sun, not in an office. Has this adventure seeker decided to fake his own disappearance?
On rare occasions, kidnappings are faked. One of those things that has to be established is this a legitimate kidnapping as opposed to a farce?
Robert's father, Tom, won't believe that theory for a minute.
I don't understand that. None of that really squares with anything that I knew. Robert was, number one, a very sincere, honest man. Loyalty was a big thing with Robert.
There's another possibility.
Unfortunately, sometimes family members or other people close to the victim are involved in these things. So we have to, through investigation, eliminate them as suspects.
Robert's father finds himself under scrutiny by the FBI and doesn't like it one bit.
They didn't exempt anybody. I mean, I was on their suspect list for quite some time, to the point where I got very angry with the FBI.
The FBI soon learns that Tom's marriage isn't as solid as people thought.
He's a chip off the old block, isn't he?
He and Pam have separated. And just a short time before Robert disappears, Tom gives his wife a large sum of money.
And I gave her $750,000.
And there's that figure again, $750,000.
So it was very interesting figure that was exactly the amount of money that was demanded in order to get their son back.
Just another coincidence? Or is Tom faking the kidnapping to get the cash back from his wife as ransom for their son? Tom Wiles says the payment is for the family's financial security.
It's not a separation agreement. She just said, I want you to leave enough money here so that we, and she specified we, would not be broke if the company went down the tube.
While the FBI looks into the wheelings and dealings of the Wiles family, another suspect emerges.
Eventually, they turn to an employee, Stephen Lindsay. He was fired from NFS. He had a drinking problem. He didn't get along that well with Mr. Wiles.
Steve was trying to come back to work at National Flight, but I would not hire him back until he was clean for 2 years.
Steve,
Steve has hit hard times since being fired, but he has a plan to get back in business, partnering National Flight Services with another company. Robert Wiles was going to make that plan happen.
Steve liked Robert, and Robert looked at Steve as a guy who could help him bring in more business, and Robert was trying to get him rehired.
But Steve's problems with the booze still have the better of him. So Tom Wiles shuts the plan down.
We cannot have anybody in our employ in the aviation industry, especially rebuilding engines, who has a reputation for being an alcoholic.
I can't go through with it, I'm sorry.
Steve Lindsay is shattered. His life is in ruins. And he swears he will get revenge.
Steve became a suspect because Steve could not account for his time when Robert went missing.
A weak alibi and a strong motive. It's a combination that puts Steve Lindsay squarely in the sights of the FBI. Problem is, when they go to round him up for more questioning,
they couldn't find him. He was nowhere to be found.
Being the child of a millionaire confers many benefits, but consider the costs. To a kidnapper's eyes, you become a walking target for easy cash. They know any parent will pay for the safe return of their child. It's just that wealthy parents can pay so much more.
When businessman Tom Wiles gets a ransom demand for his son Robert, he has only one instinct: pay the money.
Tom wanted to pay it, because Tom wanted to do whatever he could to get his son back.
How am I supposed to do it? It's my son. I cannot afford to lose my son.
But Tom soon finds himself a suspect. He's separated from his wife, and she's costing him money. Maybe he wants her to pay the ransom. That's not the only theory in the FBI's notebooks. Did his missing son fake his disappearance to escape the family business? Or was a disgruntled alcoholic former employee out for revenge?
Tom is gonna pay!
The FBI has a warning. Whoever is behind this is not to be taken lightly.
It's an aggressive crime, and it takes a certain amount of aggression and confidence to carry out that kind of crime, or you're going to take someone against their will. It's high risk, even more so than murdering somebody.
The kidnappers have an odd request. They want the money delivered to Robert's office at Lakeland Airport, Florida.
The deadline was April the 8th, and we had a box in place in Robert's office by the 8th.
Whoever comes to get that cash will be walking right into an FBI trap. SWAT teams are at the ready, and the money has been switched with coffee.
They figured out exactly how much $750,000 weighs, and then they put coffee in a suitcase instead of the money.
The FBI needs a trusted insider to help with the sting. Tom Wiles has a loyal worker in mind.
Toby.
I suggested Toby Holt because he had unlimited access to all aspects of the business.
Toby Holt was a trusted employee. He was the operations manager. He was kind of brought into the inner circle, if you will, from the FBI's perspective, and kind of helped orchestrate this and helped keep watch on that.
The April 8th ransom deadline comes and goes.
Minutes went by, hours went by, I think a week went by. No one ever came. No one touched it.
There was never a contact made by any of the kidnappers after the original note. And we never heard another word.
For a desperately worried father, it's a bad sign.
I expected the worst when we didn't hear from the kidnappers.
At this stage, Tom Wiles is no longer a suspect in his son's disappearance. Former employee Steve Lindsay is also scratched off the suspect list when he turns up in the Caribbean. Investigators are at a dead end. Then, they take a look at Robert Weil's cell phone activity.
And they realized something isn't quite right with the phone records.
The night that Tom receives the ransom email, Robert's cell phone is active near a toll booth on Florida's Polk Parkway. Tom is brought in to help review CCTV tapes. And there, amongst the hours of footage, he spots a familiar vehicle.
The FBI took me down to the Lakeland Police Department, and I observed a car that I thought was Toby's car coming through that toll booth. And it turned out that it was.
Toby Holt, Tom's most trusted employee. It doesn't add up.
There was this picture of Toby Holt holding a phone up to his head, but his phone, when they looked at the records, was not being used.
Toby Holt says he isn't on a phone at all. He's just taking a sip of soda.
So it was very strange. So that's when they really started to dig into Toby's past and into Toby's whereabouts the night Robert disappeared.
For Tom Wiles, it's an aha moment.
I was very surprised. Up to that point, I had not made any connection to Toby with respect to Robert's disappearance.
But now it all makes sense.
Rob, what's happening now?
Not much. Toby and Robert often clashed at work.
Chasing up that weekend. What's happening with that shipment?
I don't know. I asked you to sort it out, didn't I?
I'm sick of this. I'm sick of you.
Their working relationship was not good. Toby would not share information with Robert.
You can go to hell, Rob. Go to hell.
Toby wanted to take the company in one direction. Robert kind of had a different thought in mind for the company. And I think Toby felt that, you know, maybe he's not as qualified and it's probably not best for the company.
Only weeks ago, Toby Holt had been helping the FBI with their sting operation. Now, he's feeling the heat.
Toby Holt had claimed several different alibis for the night of Robert's disappearance, none of which could be proved.
He said he visited with a mistress. He said he went to a restaurant, and there was no surveillance footage of him going to these establishments, and there was no records, there was no receipts.
Then the FBI asks to search his car.
He said, there's nothing in his car, go ahead and search it. They dig around in one of the compartments, and they find a handgun.
The optics are bad for Toby Holt, but it's not enough evidence for an arrest. And the whereabouts of Robert Wiles remains a mystery.
When it comes to recovering a victim of a kidnapping alive, time is of the essence. More time passes, the more opportunity the kidnapper has to remove the victim farther away from the abduction site, to hide the victim, to secure the victim, to cover their tracks, destroy evidence.
March 2009, nearly a year after Robert's disappearance. The FBI brings in some fresh pairs of eyes to take a look at the case. They discovered that Toby Holt went shopping the night Robert went missing.
They said he went to Home Depot and got some duct tape and got a plastic bag.
And they uncover new traces of Holt's cell phone activity.
They realized that everywhere that Toby Holt went, so did Robert's cell phone.
Maybe Toby really was on a phone in that toll booth picture. Robert Wiles' cell phone. So if Toby had Robert's cell phone with him for 3 days after his disappearance, where was Robert?
Well, there's no way that Toby Holt could have Robert's telephone 3 days after he disappeared and not be involved.
Almost a year after his kidnapping, the family of Robert Wiles has lost hope of seeing him alive again. But there is still some hope of seeing justice. In December 2009, Robert's co-worker, Toby Holt, is arrested.
He flew into Orlando International Airport, and police were there to take him into custody right away. And he said he was caught by surprise.
Toby Holt is indicted for extortion, kidnapping, and murder. For Robert Weil's father, Tom, it's a bolt out of the blue. Could one of his most trusted workers have kidnapped his son?
I was surprised when he emerged as the number one suspect. I did not put those two together.
As his trial begins, Toby Holt is adamant. He didn't do it. And proving his guilt will be a challenge.
There was no body, there was no smoking gun, so they were relying on this web of circumstantial evidence.
But the circumstances are compelling. Toby Holt was the last person to see Robert Wiles alive. His alibis for that evening have no evidence to back them up. But one thing he did do that night was buy two rolls of duct tape and a box of plastic sheeting. The prosecution says that was for wrapping and dumping a body.
It was never clearly painted out how Toby Holt killed Robert Wiles. But the prosecution made it pretty clear that he had about 5 hours the night Robert Wiles disappeared. And they believe he took care of business.
Did he use the gun he had hidden in his car? Nobody knows. Prosecutors argue he did have a motive to use it.
Listen, man, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of you.
Toby Holt butted heads with Robert Wiles at work.
We can go to hell, bro. Go to hell.
He wanted the boss's son out of the picture.
I believe he was very jealous of Robert. I believe that he felt that Robert was throwing him under the bus, so to speak, and had every intention of taking his job.
And at the heart of it all is greed. Toby Holt also wants to score a payday. The answer is kidnapping.
I'm sure that he targeted our family because he knew we had access to some large amounts of cash.
There's a crucial piece of evidence that Holt has no answer for. For 3 days after he disappeared, why was the cell phone of Robert Wiles always in the same place as Toby Holt?
The most damning evidence was the cell phone trace.
It was crucial evidence that Toby Holt's phone and Robert's phone followed the same path that night.
Television news reporter Ryan Raich covered the Holt trial. And sitting in court, he felt the prosecution's circumstantial case build day by day.
You know, most people felt that Toby Holt did it, but it was so much was relying on all this circumstantial evidence. And of course, without having a body, a big question was, okay, well, can they do it? Can they prove that he actually not only killed Robert Wiles, but also was responsible for the kidnapping and the ransom note and everything else that he was charged with?
But the complicated evidence about cell phone towers is a clincher. Everywhere that Robert Wiles' phone went, so did Toby Holt's.
You know, there was no clear explanation. Okay, how could that happen if you did not have his phone and yet you were following the same path that his phone was following? I think if I was in that jury, I would say wow.
Toby's involvement also explains why the dummy ransom package was never collected.
Because Toby knew that the FBI was involved is the reason that we never heard another word from the kidnappers. He would have been a fool to touch that box.
As the trial progresses, one thing begins to stand out. Toby Holt looks very confident of his innocence.
I mean, this was a guy who was calm and collected and almost nonchalant. It certainly did not look like a man who thought he was going to be sentenced to life or sentenced to 30 years. It seemed like he thought, okay, they have the wrong guy. I'm going to get away with this and move on with my life. He was so calm and so nonchalant. It was surprising.
On March 12th, 2012, Toby Holt learns his fate.
The verdict was he was guilty of extortion and manslaughter and was sentenced to serve 30 years in jail.
He got up and said, you know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Pam and Tom, that you don't have your son, but I didn't do it.
Unfortunately, there are times where you never have a total resolution to a kidnapping. The victim's never recovered, a body's never found. It's obviously very difficult for anyone to lose a loved one, but I think it's even harder on a family where they don't know for sure and they can't have any kind of closure.
Robert Weil's body has never been found. And Toby Holt certainly isn't telling. It's the unknown that haunts Tom Weil and his family the most.
We believe he's somewhere in the Lakeland area. We don't know where else to look. You know, we know Robert's not coming back. But I'd really like to know where he is. I want to bring my boy home.
Losing a son is tragic. Never being able to bury him, unbearable. It reminds me of another mystery on the other side of the Atlantic, where a family's great prosperity threw them into the path of a monster.
In the dead of night, during a bitter English winter, a strange meeting occurs in the shadows of Stonehenge. Some believe this mysterious prehistoric site is an ancient cemetery. And tonight, death will once again shroud these sacred stones. In London, England, proud parents Anil and Nancy Chauhan are celebrating the arrival of their second child. Nancy's mother has just arrived from India, bearing gifts for her new grandson.
You know, when your papa and I got married, you weren't exactly the same.
This is a little bit sad. She came over on sort of quite extended holidays to sort of look after the children and see the family.
Anil immigrated to England a decade ago with dreams of prosperity. He married the much younger Nancy in 2000.
He was very happy with her, and he had two very young children, Davinder and Ravinder.
Anil's dreams of prosperity hang on his thriving import-export business called Sipa Freight. He's making a mint supplying fresh produce from the world's most far-flung corners.
I think certainly some of their business was based around the more exotic fruits and vegetables.
His customers range from Michelin star chefs to posh housewives. And the more exotic their tastes become, the more he cashes in.
It's fair to say that he was quite a wealthy man. He clearly was a businessman with a certain amount of acumen.
While he's worth millions, Anil's management style is casual. He even wears sweats around the office instead of a suit.
He wasn't particularly ostentatious or flashy, and he didn't display his wealth as openly as others in his position.
As profits pour in and his young family prospers, Anil's future appears to be getting brighter by the moment. Until February 13th, 2003, when his wife Nancy says he doesn't return home from work.
Nancy had become concerned about the whereabouts of Anil, so she had constantly contacted Sipa in an effort to find out where he was.
Yeah. A deal? No, that's all right. Thank you.
Nancy is told he went to a meeting out by Stonehenge.
He told his staff that there were some men that were interested in buying the company and that he was going to enter into negotiations with them.
I'm off to do a deal.
The next day, Anil still hasn't shown up. Anil's associate, Kenneth Regan, stops by. He's a businessman working with Anil to secure a land deal.
Nancy Chauhan knew Kenneth Regan, so she had daily contact with him. She'd known him from work.
So you've been worried about Anil?
He hasn't called all day.
Oh, he left a message.
Kenneth Regan assures Nancy that everything's okay. He plays a voicemail message from Anil.
Tell Nancy I'm okay. I'll be home tomorrow.
She relaxes a little and goes back to her new baby. But life will not return to normal for Nancy Chauhan. 24 hours later, Nancy, her mother, and her two young boys go missing. An entire family with a fortune in the millions has just disappeared.
Adjusting to a new culture in a foreign land isn't for everyone. When the entire Chauhan family quits London to return to India, onlookers seem to accept that English life just wasn't their cup of tea. And for one man in their circle, that homesickness for Mother India provides an unexpected windfall.
Kenneth Regan has always liked the look of Anil Chauhan's business. And now it has just fallen into his lap. He's the new boss of Seva Freight.
Anil's gone back to India. I didn't like him anymore.
Mr. Regan had turned up in Chauhan's freight warehouse and he produced this piece of paper, which was a power of attorney, which had appeared to have been signed by Mr. Chauhan.
Kenneth Regan informs the staff that their old boss has moved back to India. And now he's in charge.
Anil Chauhan was a very lackadaisical boss, from what I can gather. So people at Seba wouldn't have found it too unusual, I don't think, when Kenneth Regan turned around and said, this is what's happened.
So all the drivers and all the workers were basically, OK, Mr. Chauhan's gone. We're supposed to follow this guy now.
While his old employees don't seem to miss him, Anil Chauhan's wife, Nancy, is being missed.
Nancy had a routine whereby she would speak to her brother, Onkar Verma, who lived in New Zealand, on a regular basis.
Onkar Verma became increasingly worried about his sister.
Onkar Verma was unable to contact Nancy, so he then made inquiries at Seba Freight.
Nancy's brother Onkar has Anil's power of attorney documents faxed to him, and they just don't look right.
The signature at the bottom of the supposed power of attorney was a mere squiggle and was nothing like the genuine signature of Anil Chauhan.
That squiggle is enough to get him on a plane to London. 2 weeks after his sister's disappearance, he walks through her front door.
The place looked as if it had just been walked out of.
Food was half prepared in the kitchen.
Ketchup bottles on the table and food and in the cupboards. It was very mysterious.
This is not the home of a family who has moved overseas. Where are Anil and Nancy? Nancy's mother and their two little boys, Ravinder and Devinder. Onkar then finds something very troubling.
His mother, Chandrik Kaur, she'd left her holy book behind. She was a very devout follower, and as a result of which, she would have always had that with her.
Why would this very religious woman leave behind this Sikh holy book if she was joining the rest of her family, you know, living abroad?
Onkar Verma gets on the phone to Scotland Yard and makes a plea. Find my sister and her family. detectives start digging into the Chohans' affairs.
You do background checks on the family, if they're using their credit cards, if they're using money, how they're living.
But no one has touched their bank accounts. It's time to start looking at their potential enemies.
It could have been anything. It could have been a family feud. It could have been to do with his business. Anil Chohan had in the past sort of fallen foul of the law. He'd been prosecuted and convicted and even spent some time in jail for tax evasion.
Anil has another secret. Some of his fruit and vegetable imports are getting a little too exotic.
Rumors surfaced that the company, Seba Freight, had been involved in the import and export of a substance called cat.
Cat is a narcotic shrub grown in Africa. When chewed, it gives users a high similar to cocaine. Its legality is a gray area.
It's legal to import it to the UK, but it's, however, illegal to export it to the USA.
Because of the nature of Anil Chohan's business, it would have been perfectly feasible for him to be involved in the movement of cat.
And it was suggested that perhaps Anil had fallen foul of rival importers, and this was why he had disappeared.
Dabbling in the black market always comes with a risk. Has Anil pushed too far and paid the ultimate price? Detectives look to Seba's newly minted manager, Kenneth Regan, for answers.
The story was from Regan. Chohan had decided to just leave the country, maybe partly under pressure from these cat exporter people.
He said that Anil had looked for a false passport, he's looking to leave the country.
The lead sounds promising. Until just after Easter.
Parcel tape had been wrapped around his face, covering his nose and mouth.
The dead body of Anil Chohan is found floating off the south coast of England.
The body was so badly decomposed that identification had to be done by fingerprints.
And hidden on his body, a secret that will expose the evil at the heart of this case. In January 2003, London businessman Anil Chohan is busy running Seba Freight, a multi-million dollar import-export company. In February, he doesn't return from a mysterious late-night meeting. And in April, his cold, dead body is found in the sea off the coast of England.
We had circumstances that are unusual leading up to his death, and it then became a legitimate murder investigation.
And with Anil Chohan dead, police hold grave fears for his wife, her mother, and their two young boys, all missing. Just as Anil's body is identified, detectives get a new lead. They race to the country estate of a manager recently employed in Anil Chohan's freight business.
That there'd been some activity in one of her fields where men had been digging up part of the field with diggers.
As police sift through the soil, they find something.
There was jewelry found in the ditch.
It looks like a mass grave, but the bodies are missing.
They found evidence under the soil that bodies had been interred there, and there was a partial DNA profile belonging to Anil Chohan.
Where is the rest of the Chohan family? The owner of the field has a name for the police. The man who did the digging was Seba Freight's new boss, Kenneth Regan. Regan had dug the field with two friends, Peter Reese and William Hornsey. When police come knocking on their doors, they've all flown the coop.
They both traveled by ferry to France and disappeared.
doesn't take long to discover that Kenneth Regan has a dark, violent past.
Kenneth Regan had a criminal background, and he had previously served a significant term of imprisonment for drug importation offences.
Kenneth Regan was basically making a living smuggling heroin into the country.
Kenneth Regan will stop at nothing to get what he wants. He visited Nancy Chauhan the day after her husband went missing. Did her suspicions drive him to take the most drastic step of all? Murder an entire family. Kill two babies, ages 18 months and 4 weeks. While Regan's on the run in Europe, bodies begin to wash ashore back in England.
They were those of Nancy and her mother. Nancy's body was discovered by a fisherman very close to the Isle of Wight, and in fact, not very much at all remained.
In September 2003, police find and arrest Kenneth Regan and his henchmen.
All three pleaded not guilty to the offences right from the outset.
In November 2004, the trio goes on trial for murder in London's Old Bailey Criminal Court. They claim a drug smuggling gang forced them to dump the bodies of the Chauhan family. The truth is somewhat different.
What we do know is that Anil Chauhan was called to and attended the meeting with Kenneth Regan at Stonehenge in February 2003.
Kenneth, what is this?
You've had your chance. Now we're going to do things out.
I'm not doing this deal.
Subsequently, he was abducted, held captive by Regan at his address, and forced to sign various documentation. Police believe, including the power of attorney.
Over several days, Anil Chauhan is tortured by Regan and his henchmen.
How about now? No.
Eventually, Anil is broken. He signs over power of attorney. And then records the voicemail to Nancy.
Tell Nancy I'm okay. I'll be home tomorrow.
Good, that's better.
The voicemail to Nancy was in English, which was unusual because they spoke to each other in Punjabi normally. Anil Chauhan was a very intelligent man. I've got no doubt at all the fact that he left the message in English was part of his way of trying to get across that something was wrong.
Anil Chauhan knows he's about to die. So he makes a final heroic move in the hope his killers will one day face justice.
He found a piece of paper somewhere within that house and decided to conceal it on himself.
He seized the note and folded it and put it in his sock. And he was subsequently murdered.
Anil Chauhan is dead. But Kenneth Regan doesn't want any loose ends. To tie them up, he's prepared to murder the entire Chauhan family and bury them in a field.
I was never able to prove that all the family were in there. The only body I could prove was in there was Anil Chauhan's. But I find it inconceivable that they dug a grave the size they did do and buried the rest of the family elsewhere.
But the bodies don't stay buried for long.
Due to police activity, Regan got spooked and exhumed all five bodies again and then transported them to the south coast, where by boat they were dumped in the sea.
Kenneth Regan was driven by one thing: cold-hearted greed.
Regan's motive for the deaths of these five members of this family are purely financial gain.
An import-export business is the perfect cover for a drug smuggler. Anil Chauhan's company was Regan's shortcut to the criminal good life.
He wanted a front business. His plan was to take over this company and use it to smuggle drugs, mainly from Spain.
costing over $15 million. The trial is one of the longest and most expensive in English history. And the clinching piece of evidence comes from a desperate father who knows he's about to die.
When his socks were taken off, there was a piece of paper basically folded up inside of one of those socks.
It takes a forensic lab weeks to decipher the note.
When it was opened, it was actually a letter from the Cheltenham and Gloucester Building Society to Kenneth Regan at Forge Close.
Kenneth Regan was eventually convicted of all five murders. So that's all five members of the Chohan family. He will never be released and he will die in prison.
Regan's henchman, William Hornsey, is also convicted of five murders, receiving life without parole. Peter Rees is found guilty of one murder and given 23 years.
For me, and I think all the officers that worked on this case, the most disturbing angle is really the brutality that took place. To think that someone could stoop so low as to murder three generations of the family purely for financial gain, I think I find the most shocking aspect to this whole murder investigation.
Kenneth Regan never divulged how three generations of the Chohan family were wiped out in one weekend. And he still won't tell where the tiniest generation is buried.
The one issue that police would very much like to resolve is what happened to the two small boys, Ravinder and Davinder. Their bodies have never been recovered, and it's a tragic element to this case that they've never been found.
Innocent lives were ended, families destroyed forever. And all for what? A few lousy dollars. The promise of a ransom and a taste for revenge was enough to turn Toby Holt into a killer, while Kenneth Regan made women and children collateral damage in his evil quest for riches. There was a moral line, and the lure of easy money convinced them to cross it, arriving at a pitiless place where they would kill for cash. Till next we meet behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.